Of the Senate Judiciary Committee to order. It is 1:35 p.m. on Monday, March 25th, 2024. Before we begin, I want to thank Juliana Singh, the Senate Judiciary Secretary, who makes sure we have a transcript of our meetings, and Dylan Williams from the Juneau LIO, who makes sure we have sound. This time, I want to remind committee members and all those in the room to please silence your cell phones. Present day, we have Senator Kaufman, Senator Giesel, Senator Tobin, my Vice Chair, Senator Keel, and myself, Senator Clayman. We have a quorum and a complete committee. Our first order of business today is House Joint Resolution 3, Concealed Handgun Reciprocity Between States, sponsored by Representative Rauscher. This is the second hearing of the resolution in the Senate Judiciary Committee. Last week, we heard HJR 3, and there were questions from the committee for Leg Legal. Today, we have Leg Legal on the line, Claire Radford, and our only intention with the resolution is to get committee and questions answered that we have from Ms. Radford. Representative Rauscher, you're welcome to join us at the front, although we may or not call, ask you to say anything, but you're certainly welcome to come join us up front. And Ms. Radford, you're on the line. I know if you're on a phone, well, you're obviously on a phone, please make sure you're not on a speakerphone, as the sound is not as clear and often difficult to hear what you say. And I'll open it up for questions for Ms. Radford. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Radford, one of the biggest questions we asked the previous committee was about the text of the federal proposed law that the resolution endorses. And specifically, it went to how exactly the word is reciprocity here, works. And I was looking at U.S. House Resolution 38, and the question had to do with whether a person who does not have a concealed carry permit but lives in a state that allows concealed carry without a permit may, if this legislation is passed, carry a concealed firearm in a state that requires a permit for its residence.
This is Claire Radford with Legislative Legal Services. Through the chair, Senator Keel. My understanding of how the Federal Reciprocity Act is written is that this would not allow a person from carrying concealed in a state that requires a concealed carry permit who does not possess a concealed carry permit in the state where that person resides.
Thank you. And follow-up? Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And so then the next question, just an additional layer of detail. If a person resides in a state with more permissive, permitless carry, for instance, allowing 19-year-olds to carry without a permit, travels to a state that only allows concealed carry by 21 and older, could they, under this federal legislation it passed, could they carry in the state with the otherwise higher standard?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, my reading of the federal bill would be that a person would have to have a concealed carry permit from the home state in which they reside in order to carry in another state that either has a statute where the residents of that state may apply for a license, or a state that doesn't prohibit carrying concealed firearms by residents of that state for lawful purposes. So if a person who is 19 does not possess a concealed carry permit in the state where they reside, they would be unable to go to another state where it would be a requirement of a concealed carry permit that the person would be 21 or older. The 19-year-old would not be able to conceal carry in that state.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman, because that answer is confusing. It seems at odds with the first answer. And I just, as I go through H.R. 38, it says that notwithstanding other state laws, a person who's not prohibited by federal law from possessing a firearm, as long as they're carrying a valid ID, photo ID, if they're entitled to carry a concealed carry firearm in the state in which the person resides, they may possess or carry a concealed firearm handgun, it says here, in any state that does not prohibit the carrying of concealed firearms. So can you square the first two answers in the bill's text?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, the federal provisions would require a person to not be prohibited by federal law from possessing, transporting, shipping, or receiving a firearm. They would have to carry a valid identification containing a photograph of themselves, and they would also have to carry a valid license or permit that has been issued pursuant to the law of a state that permits the person to carry a concealed firearm. I apologize. I see what you're saying was the or is entitled to carry a concealed firearm in the state in which the person resides. To correct myself, it would appear that if a 19-year-old in another state is entitled to carry a concealed firearm in that state without a concealed carry permit, that they would be able to do so in another state that either has a statute under which residents of the state may apply for a license or permit to carry a concealed firearm, or a state that does not prohibit the carrying of a concealed firearm by residents of that state for lawful purposes.
I have a slightly different follow-up on it's related, and I don't know these different states, so let's just say state A will issue a concealed carry permit to somebody who's 19, and state B will only issue a concealed carry permit to a person who's 21. If under this federal law, the person who is 19 and has the authorized concealed carry permit from state A where he or she lives, arrives in state B at age 19 and presents their concealed carry permit in state B that does not allow concealed carry until you're 21, would the proposed federal law mean that the 19-year-old is allowed to conceal carry in state B where they try to restrict that to 21-year-olds?
Again, this is Claire Radford with Legislative Legal Services. Senator Klayman, that's correct. The federal bill says that a person who carries or possesses a concealed handgun in accordance with the requirements of A and B of that bill may not be arrested or otherwise detained for a violation of any law or any rule or regulation of a state related to possession, transportation, or carrying unless there's probable cause to believe they're doing so in a manner not provided for by federal law.
Senator Tobin, I know you had some questions the last go around. I have you on my list with questions, but I'm not 100% you wanted to be on the list, so I'm calling on you anyway.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think my questions have been answered. And I can drill down to a more specific question just because it's one that I think is illustrative. So in Colorado, a person must complete a safety training to conceal carry. Here in Alaska, we do not have the stipulation. You can conceal carry without completing a safety course. So my question would be, would a person from Alaska who's visiting Colorado be able to conceal and carry without first completing that required safety course?
Through the chair, Senator Tobin, I believe so based on my reading of this federal law, since a person would... I apologize. I am not 100% sure of my answer on that one. I would be happy to follow up with you after committee.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And my follow-up question, Mr. Chair, is on page 6, starting on line 1, the federal bill identifies that particular federal lands, national park systems, national wildlife refuge systems, public land under the Bureau of Land Management, and so forth, would be open to a person possessing or carrying a concealed handgun. And I know here in the state of Alaska that we do have particular stipulations with certain state and federal lands where you can and cannot carry firearms. Would this bill supersede those current U.S. codes and laws currently enacted?
Through the chair, Senator Tobin, I would have to do some more research into that. I typically, you know, don't work with federal statutes or federal bills. I would be happy to take a look into that further for you, but I'm not sure how this would impact any of those current requirements.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just for the record, my spouse is a federal law officer for the Bureau of Land Management.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Radford, a little bit more specific question, and it begins on page 3 of the federal legislation. That the federal bill is generally an act of preemption, right? Broadly, it exists to preempt state laws. There is a carve-out that starts at line 19 there, and it continues on to the next page. But the carve-out says, as I understand it, that they're not going to preempt Alaska's law that lets me as a homeowner say you can't concealed carry in my home. And we're not going to carve out or not going to preempt any state law that doesn't allow a person to carry concealed firearms in a state government building. Alaska law has some other provisions. You can't carry concealed in a bar. You can't carry concealed at a daycare. I may be forgetting one. So, Ms. Radford, can you help me understand whether, since those Alaska laws are not generally preempted by this federal legislation if it's passed, do those stand as applied to people from other states?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, I am not sure of what impact this would have on Alaska's prohibitions for carrying in a bar, for example. I would be happy to look into that further for you. It isn't specifically listed here for other properties that are not owned by state or local government, but I would be happy to look into that further.
Thank you.
I don't see other questions for other members of the committee. I do have at least one other line I wanted to follow up on, and this is with respect to Alaska's, to make sure I understand Alaska's laws about concealed carry. Do we have a concealed carry permit in Alaska?
Senator Clement, yes, we do have concealed handgun permits in Alaska. Those are provided for in the Department of Public Safety is in charge of issuing those, and we do have a way that you can apply for and receive a concealed handgun permit, although it is not necessary if you're over the age of 21.
And do we have any provisions about reciprocity with other states in our statutes?
Senator Clement, yes, we do have a statute related to reciprocity agreements. That's at AS 1865-775. And the Department of Public Safety is authorized to enter into those agreements with other states.
So let's take an example. In Alaska, after you're 21, you don't need to have a permit, but under 21, you're supposed to get a permit to have concealed carry. Can you explain how we would manage it if another state that provided a concealed carry permit under different rules than Alaska has, would we respect the terms of that other state's concealed carry permit, or would we expect those states' terms to match up with Alaska's?
Senator Clement, to clarify, you are unable to receive a concealed carry permit if you're under the age of 21 in Alaska. If you're under the age of 21, it's a against the criminal statutes for you to conceal carry in terms of how reciprocity agreements work with lining up the requirements of other states' concealed carry requirements and Alaska's concealed carry requirements. I would recommend you discuss that with the Department of Public Safety, since I'm not really sure how they decide what reciprocity agreements to enter into with other states.
So a question to ask them to make sure I get the right question. Ms. Puritan is here, so I'll call her up next. But the scenario would be Alaska doesn't allow concealed carry under 21, but another state might. And so the question would be for the Department of Public Safety how they would deal with the reciprocity question under our existing law about a state that allows concealed carry under 21. Is that the right question, Ms. Radford?
Yes, Senator Klayman, I believe that would be the correct question, yeah.
So, Ms. Purinton, if you would come join us.
For the record, Lisa Purinton with Department of Public Safety, Division of Statewide Services Director and Acting Legislative Liaison for the Department. To the chair, to your question on the reciprocity, the department does enter into reciprocity agreements with several states, but the agreements are usually based, are not usually, they are based on the other state having similar statutes to what the state law in Alaska requires. So for instance, if another state had restrictions that were not in compliance with our state laws, then that is not an agreement that we would enter into with the other state. So in the example that I believe the committee was talking about for the 19-year-old, then that is not something we could enter an agreement with, because our state law requires the individual to be 21 years of age to have that reciprocity.
So the approach the department has taken is that Alaska will grant reciprocity to another state, but the first test is to make sure that the restrictions in the other state are consistent with the restrictions in Alaska.
Through the chair, that's correct.
Okay. Senator Tobin.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have an interesting follow-up. There are states that have additional training requirements or other barriers, like you cannot have been convicted of a domestic violence infringement or something to that effect. Would we enter into an agreement with a state that has more restrictive concealed carry permitting, or have we entered into a state that has more restrictive?
Through the chair to Senator Tobin, I'd have to double check on that, but generally our state law, in order to get a concealed carry permit in Alaska, not only do you have to comply with the Alaska requirements, you have to be qualified to carry under federal requirements. And so those other federal requirements that are usually outlined by the Department of ATF, Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, they will generally set that out in U.S. code that says, for instance, the domestic violence, misdemeanor crimes of domestic violence, when those certain partnerships are listed met between the victim and the defendant. Other types of requirements such as that will have to be met in addition to the state law requirements.
Any other questions for Ms. Purinton? Hearing and seeing none. Any other questions for Ms. Radford? Hearing and seeing none. That was all we had on HJR 3. Representative Rauscher, you're here. Did you want to add anything?
Yes.
Looks like you've got something to add. Go ahead.
Yeah.
We'll go ahead and hear
Representative
you.
Rauscher, on the record, District 29. We do have a statement from the sponsor of the HR 38. We had asked him question, do you non-residents visiting a state have to abide by the conceal and carry laws of the state? His answer was yes. HR 38 is intended to allow individuals with concealed carry privileges in their home state to exercise those rights in any other state that allows concealed carry while still abiding by that state's laws. The goal of the bill is to reduce confusion and legal inconsistencies for responsible gun owners when they travel outside their home state, while also respecting the state's rights in the states that they are visiting.
And who is that from?
This was from Congressman Richard Hudson, Republican, North Carolina, District 9.
Okay, so this is for H.R. 38.
H.R. 38.
Okay.
Correct.
Thank you. I was looking at you as the bill sponsor as opposed to the...
No. I was talking about the sponsor of the actual bill, which is what the resolution is trying to agree with. I apologize for not making that clear through the chair. Thank you.
That's okay. Thank you very much, Representative Rauscher. Any questions for Representative Rauscher? I don't see any. Thank you very much. We are going to set aside H.J.R. 3 for further review. Our next and last order of business today is Senate Bill 258, Crime Conviction Overturned, Received, Passed, Permanent Fund Dividend, sponsored by the Senate State Affairs Committee. This is the first hearing of the bill in the Senate Judiciary Committee. Here to present the bill is the Senate State Affairs Committee Chair, Scott Kawasaki, and his staff. Joe Hayes, if you would both please come forward, identify yourselves for the record, and you can begin your remarks.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the Judiciary Committee. Scott Kawasaki, Senate District P, representing Fairbanks, Fort Wainwright, and Badger. Wanted to thank the members of the committee for hearing Senate Bill 258 on behalf of the Senate State Affairs Committee. In the state of Alaska, if someone's convicted of a felony, they no longer become eligible to receive their permanent fund dividend for that qualifying year and for any additional year in which they are incarcerated. Currently, in the event of someone's conviction is later deemed invalid or it's vacated, nothing in statute would allow them to receive their PFDs that were incorrectly withheld from them. Senate Bill 258 would ensure that Alaskans are paid back their PFDs that are rightfully theirs. Just as is done with the prior year dividend fund liabilities, which is a separate fund within the permanent fund dividend, the money to pay these back payments would come out of that permanent fund in the form of a reduction created for the purpose directly by the Department of Revenue. And that amount of money taken out of the permanent fund by the Department of Revenue is calculated based on the estimated cases that particular qualifying year. Once the bill goes into effect, the minute someone would be eligible for receiving back PFDs for a vacated or reversed or dismissed conviction, the court system would notify the Department of Revenue, send over necessary documents, and the department would then take the necessary steps to calculate for the potential payout. Research suggests that there would be between 4 to 20 claimants, though we can't actually know for certain until people begin to make those claims. For the first year, we expect the payout would be around at least $103,000, which was an estimate that was made when a similar bill like this had passed the House of Representatives in the 30th legislature. Let's see. At this point, eligibility is difficult to discern because it requires combing through court records to find the rare instances where individuals may qualify. However, from data we do have, we can again estimate that there would be an average of 2 to 3 claims per year. Typically, they would only be for a few PFD qualifying years, not necessarily always in longer cases. So, Mr. Chairman and members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, I think this is sound and relatively simple legislation that corrects a serious injustice for Alaskans. And in particular, I just wanted to close by saying thank you for hearing the bill. This can also help in what I hope the transition back to civilian life for those individuals who may have lost time with loved ones, lost their jobs, or otherwise lost income. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. Senator Keel, I looked once and you didn't have your hand up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You're very quick. a question, and I don't know, Senator, whether it's for you or Ms. Mead. There is a there are a couple of bills pending that would vacate judgments in some very limited circumstances. And I think that your bill is narrower than to make those apply, but I want to get an understanding. So there's a proposal, it's in a governor's bill, to vacate judgments of those who were victims of sex trafficking if they were convicted of prostitution, specifically of selling. Right? Do I understand the bill correctly that it's not enough only to have a judgment vacated? You must also have the charges dismissed or an actual finding of not guilty on a retrial.
So through the chair, Senator Keel, that probably would be a question better addressed to Nancy Mead, but I will say that the purpose and intent is so that if there is a conviction and it had been vacated or reversed and dismissed or overturned by a trial, then the person would be eligible for the permanent fund dividend that they were not eligible or made ineligible for during the conviction. But that the technicality would probably be something that Nancy Mead would probably be able to answer better.
Well, I can see that everyone wants to hear from Nancy Mead. Ms. Mead, please come forward. When they call your name once, we think it's likely. Because they call your name twice, there's no escape.
Thank you for the record, Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System. I did hear the question. The bill that I'm familiar with that's pending right now would vacate somebody's conviction for prostitution if other things come into play. Under the PFD statute, you lose your PFD if you are incarcerated, and it was a felony, and prostitution is not a felony, or a misdemeanor if they have two priors and they have two prior misdemeanors. So it could be for the B misdemeanor of prostitution, which has a max of 10 days imprisonment, that there could be some individuals who would be who would fall under the category of we would vacate under that bill, and they did not get their PFD. I would estimate that is extremely small. But my read of this bill is that if the court does vacate, because the statute says these are the situations, and the person didn't get their PFD because they fit all those other things, that in my view, the plain meaning of this is that the person could go back to the PFD office and seek their PFD.
Senator Keel?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Mead, the question specifically is to the proposed I-1 here, because in that vacatur of judgment provision, my understanding was that was something the court did, and there wasn't a subsequent step of dismissal of charges. So are these two, in fact, different?
Through the chair to Senator Keel. I don't like when people say it, but that's a good question. I think I would have to think about it and see how the Department of Law would apply it. I don't think that would be a call for us. I think that the Department of Revenue could be presented by the person with this piece of paper. And in my opinion, I am not sure how that would be applied in that circumstance. I'm sorry. I see your point.
Senator Tobin.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think this might be for the bill sponsor, or maybe perhaps Ms. Mead. I'm thinking of a well-known case, the Fairbanks Four, and that how would this might apply to that population, and would this help bring justice to those individuals?
My understanding, but I'm sure the sponsor would speak to it, is that this is the circumstance that occurred with those individuals. And my understanding, and again, I think the Department of Revenue needs to consult the Department of Law when they're brought one of these orders from our decisions of the appellate court, is that it would. But that would not exactly be the court's call.
And I would note that Corey Bigelow from the Department of Revenue is online and available for questions. Do we want to direct that question to Mr. Bigelow? Or does Senator Kawasaki, do you want first shot?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And yeah, that I will just say that in the case of the Fairbanks 4, this bill would specifically correct, I think, what was a miscarriage of justice. However, I will say that this goes to any person who was wrongly convicted. And so really, this is an issue of justice. It's an issue of ensuring that a person who was wrongfully incarcerated or wrongfully convicted has an opportunity. And many, many states have introduced laws like this. Some of them have introduced things like the ability to waive tuition and fees at their public colleges and universities. I'll just say Texas was a state that recently had done that. We're unique in the state of Alaska in that we have a permanent fund dividend, which it is unique. And so there's different ways that we can address the issue of wrongful conviction compensation. This is just one very, very small part to that.
I would note as a graduate of the University of Texas that I would suggest that a free tuition to the University of Texas in Texas, or for that matter, the University of Alaska in Alaska, is probably worth more than a dividend.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's not really a question. Did we have questions for Mr. Bigelow from Department of Revenue, or did we want him to respond to any of the prior questions? Senator Tobin, you look like you're on the edge of wanting to ask.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think I'm trying to understand page 2 to 3, the transition language, and it's the applicability of who becomes eligible. Is anyone who's had a sentence vacated become eligible? Is it? I think I'm just having difficulty understanding the transition language.
And we'll start with Senator Kawasaki. Can you walk us through the transition language, or do you want to see if Claire Radford's available to talk about it, or she may have been in the drafter?
So this could come under the reading of the sectional analysis, but from the sectional analysis, it would seem to mean that the people who, under Section 3, those who would be eligible for PFD compensation is defined under the prior Section 1 of the bill, but have yet had their convictions overturned before this act takes place, will have 1 year from its effective date. So that's the transition, is that they'll have 1 year after that effective date of the bill.
So they sort of have a statute of limitations to apply for the dividend?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
All right. I guess I don't see anybody with a question for Mr. Bigelow. So Mr. Bigelow, I think you're off the hook. We're next going to go to invited testimony. And we have online Jory Knott, Executive Director of Alaska Innocence Project. Mr. Knott, if you want to identify yourself for the record, you can begin your remarks. And I'd specifically ask that if you are on a speakerphone, please do not stay on the speakerphone. Mr. Knott.
Hello, Mr. Chairman, Alaska Senate Judiciary Committee. You guys hear me okay?
Yes.
Great. Thank you for your time. Appreciate your recognition regarding this bill. My name is Jory Knott. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Innocence Project and a lifelong Alaskan. I'm testifying on behalf of SB 258, which would, as per the comments of the sponsor, amend the permanent fund dividend statute to allow for back payment of PFDs for the years a wrongfully convicted Alaska was wrongfully incarcerated. Three quick points is this bill has a zero fiscal note, as mentioned. This bill is nonpartisan. And passing this bill is simply the right thing to do. On the zero fiscal note, I did want to point, as Senator Kawasaki said, it would come from prior year dividends. From all the math we've done, prior year dividends are ample enough to take care of the Fairbanks 4 case, as well as any future work by us. There's zero impact also to the restorative justice or victim impact fund subsidiaries that were carved out from felons while their permanent funds while they are incarcerated. So this doesn't have a criminal justice note per se either. This bill is nonpartisan. I want to note that this bill is mirrored by House Bill 342, sponsored by Representative Frank Tomaszewski of the House Majority. And it's receiving strong bipartisan support, just as it did in 2017, and community support as well. The actors who had a lot of concern for this passed shortly after the Fairbanks 4 exoneration are renewing their recommendation, and we have plenty of other actors that are stepping up to do the same. This bill is simply the right thing to do because, as Senator Kawasaki said, it's an integral piece of what it means to be Alaskan is to get your permanent fund. As it stands, a release of an individual who served time under a quote-unquote correct conviction received services, reentry services, and there's been efforts by the legislature to work on recidivism prevention and reintegration. A wrongfully convicted Alaskan receives nothing under the current Alaska law. Finally, I do think, you know, from our point of view, and I heard the questions as per future legislation kind of in the works. But, you know, here at the Alaska Innocence Project, we have to find a claim of actual innocence and prove it beyond clear and convincing evidence under AS-12. The point I'm getting at is that, yeah, I appreciated the confidence from Senator Kawasaki that, you know, there's going to be a lot of these per year. I started volunteering with Alaska Innocence Project 8 years ago. We have had one exoneration of the Fairbanks 4 where that claim of actual innocence was met and that this would apply for. As it goes for other future other legislation, I can't comment to that, but I will say that we have a very small nonprofit, and we do have case law in the works, but it's been since 2017, and we have had four findings of innocence and exonerations. Lastly, I want to say this bill points towards a just and productive future for present and future convicted Alaskans. We at the Alaska Innocence Project know that wrongful convictions do indeed occur and have occurred in our state. No criminal justice is perfect. In fact, I just returned this last weekend from a wrongful conviction conference in New Orleans. It was a quick couple-day thing where the exonerees who attended accounted for over 6,600 combined years of wrongful imprisonment. I'm just about to choke up just thinking about it. It was quite the weekend. These are not vacations. But yeah, at least I'm not wrongfully imprisoned. And most of the time the criminal justice system does get it right. But when it doesn't, wrongfully convicted Alaskans deserve an apology, a warm welcome home, a means to contribute back into the economy, and at the very least, the same right to the Alaska Permanent Fund as the rest of us. As it stands, this bill, you know, them not being able to get their permanent fund is the second injustice upon the release, in our humble opinion. Thank you very much for your time, committee, and I'm free to answer any questions you might have. Thank you.
I don't see any questions from other members of the committee, so I'll ask a related question to what I asked, the comment I made to Senator Kawasaki. Why aren't we including tuition considerations at the University of Alaska if we're trying to not only support folks that have lost civil rights, but also try to help them reintegrate? Wouldn't a university education be more valuable than a check?
If you're asking me, I'm not sure where you direct that question.
I'm asking you.
Well, we are one of 13 states, 12 or 13. I know there's one in the works, states in the nation that give zero compensation for wrongful conviction. That number is dwindling every year. There's a strong movement going towards, reintegration of tuition, housing, job training, et cetera. Ironically, Texas had a slew of wrongful convictions when the Innocence Project started in 1996 under the DNA testing, and they now have the most robust, reintegration program. To be very frank, there is just our population so small. There's been studies that from, and no defense attorneys included, but from prosecution judges and law enforcement that show that 2 to 5% of convictions are wrongful. That would mean that we're upwards, even on the 2% side, close to 100, under 100 here in Alaska. Again, population, and me being I am the executive director, or I am the Innocence Project right now. It was Bill Oberle. I do have volunteers. We do have a lot of support and the community's support, but we can only work so hard. If we had a slew of wrongful convictions coming through, it might be a different story. Because one thing that fundraises better for us and makes change happen quicker than anything is a face of a wrongful convicted individual asking for a little bit of help.
Okay, thank you very much. I don't see any other questions from members of the committee. I'm going to go ahead and open public testimony on House Bill or Senate Bill 258. I'm going to first look and see in the room if there's anybody that would like to provide public testimony on Senate Bill 258. If so, please come forward. Please identify yourself for the record, and we generally limit public testimony to 2 minutes, so you can identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Brian Ridley, and I'm the Chief Chairman of the Tanana Chiefs Conference. Thank you for the opportunity to provide public testimony in strong support of Senate Bill 258 today. In December, almost 9 years ago, Tanana Chiefs Conference celebrated the release from prison the men known as the Fairbanks Four: Marvin Roberts, George Fries, Eugene Vent, and Kevin Peace. These men had maintained their innocence for 19 years, pursuing post-conviction relief options through every avenue, even years after the state of Alaska had received evidence that supported their innocence. The state did not provide these men with reparations to transition back into daily life. Despite their proven innocence, the difficulty of reentering society is profound for the wrongfully convicted. The failure to compensate them adds insult to injury. The young men that were arrested in 1996 reentered the world having spent their formative years in a concrete cell. They had lost work and education opportunities, social and relationship opportunities, things that are hard to put a price on. But throughout the entire time that any Alaskan is fighting for their innocence, one thing is not lost: the fact that they are Alaskans. There's one thing that everyone in Alaska has an opinion on. Unfortunately, it isn't reparations for the wrongfully convicted. It is the PFD. What better way to welcome someone who has freshly reclaimed their innocence than by reminding them that their Alaskan reward is still waiting for them? We were delighted in 2017 when then Representative Kawasaki introduced this legislation and championed it through the House with an overwhelming show of support. Now, 7 years later, we continue to believe that Senate Bill 258 is an important first step in ensuring the integrity of our criminal justice system. Currently, the federal government, the District of Columbia, and 30 states have compensation statutes. 20 states do not. Alaska is one of those 20. This is not an honor distinction. Please support this important legislation. Thank you. Masi Cho.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone else in the room who would like to provide public testimony? Hearing and seeing no one, I'm going to look online. And I do not see anyone online for public testimony, so I'm going to close public testimony. And we are going to hold Senate Bill 258 for further review. If anyone is considering,
Senator Giesman. Mr. Chairman, before you do that, could I offer some thoughts?
Yes, absolutely. On Senate Bill 258.
Yes,
absolutely.
You know the theory here, I agree with. What I'm wondering about, and I know this isn't the Finance Committee, but the financial logistics are a question to me. As I look at the fiscal note, it says zero, and yet in the narrative it says the division is unable to know how many Alaskans. That sounds like an indeterminate fiscal note to me. That's just A.
Right.
But secondly, the logistics. When we have a dividend each year, there's a certain amount of money that comes from the percent of the market value. We determine what percent of that goes to dividends, and it's divided by the number of people with correct applications, with accepted applications. And so that sets the amount of the dividend. So these are for past dividends that have already been distributed. Where would this new money come from? Would it come from this year's distribution? In which case it changes the calculation. I may have missed that because I think I missed the first hearing on this bill, but perhaps not.
Well, this is the first hearing.
Oh, is it? Okay. Well,
we have Mr. Bigelow on the line still.
That would be interesting.
And Mr. Bigelow, I know we're a little out of order, but Mr. Bigelow, are you still with us?
Thank you, Chair, committee members. For the record, Corey Bigelow, PFD Operations Manager. To the Chair, Senator Giesel, you are correct. The division is unable to know how many Alaskans, so you are correct. The fiscal note should be indeterminate at this time. But other than not knowing how many individuals potentially be applying, I believe Senator Kawasaki mentioned in his opening remarks about using the liability fund. Depending on how many individuals would be applying for this in the first year, or how many years this would occur, I don't know if the liability fund would have enough available in it or not. I don't have the amount of the fund in front of me right now. I apologize for that. We can get that to you at some time. But that was Senator Kawasaki's comments originally at the beginning of his presentation.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. No follow-up.
Okay. Any further comments? Okay. Hearing and seeing none. We're going to hold Senate Bill 258 for further review. If anyone is considering offering an amendment to either Senate Bill 258 or House Joint Resolution 3, Concealed Handgun Reciprocity Between States, sponsored by Representative Rauscher, please let our office know. With respect to the Senate Bill 58, we'll make the deadline for that Friday, April 5th, and the deadline for the Concealed Handgun Reciprocity Between States will make that Wednesday, April 3rd. Both those are at 5 p.m. At that point, we will adjourn for the day. Our next meeting is Wednesday, March 27 at 1:30 p.m. We stand adjourned. The time is now 2:23 p.m.